Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 186. We are long overdue for another listener Q&A. So for the first time since this past December, I'm going to go through some of the emails and direct messages that we've received. If you do have additional questions for future ones, please reach out. You can get in touch with us at elitebaseballpodcast@gmail.com. And with that said, we will get to the questions. Overuse injuries have emerged as one of the biggest threats to players at every level of competition. As an example, at the professional level, ulnar collateral ligament injuries at the elbow alone sideline pitchers for an average of over 17 months. That's a ton of lost development and a threat to lengthy careers. Just as concerningly, though, for youth players, overuse is the predominant mechanism of injury. So what can be done? Obviously, we need to train athletes to be prepared for all the stresses the game throws at them. However, the other side of the equation, recovery, often doesn't get the attention it deserves. Healthy, recovered arms mean you can stay in the game and give your best on the field, and that's where Mark Pro comes in. Mark Pro is a cutting-edge recovery tool that provides all the benefits of active recovery, but without the extra effort, muscular fatigue, or stress to tendons and joints. Players can use Mark Pro as long as needed for exceptional recovery between training sessions or after games. We'll often send Mark Pro units back with athletes to their hotels or even have them use them on team flights. Both easy to use and portable, Mark Pro is a powerful tool that allows recovery anywhere, anytime. Use it while relaxing at home, on the road, or during tournaments. On a personal note, I was originally a naysayer when it came to Mark Pro. However, longtime Cressy Sports performance athlete Corey Kluber turned me onto it. He adopted Mark Pro into his post-pitching recovery approach, and it was an integral part of him going out and throwing 200 innings year after year. This led me to experiment with it myself and with more of our athletes, and the feedback was consistently outstanding. Now, just a few years later, you'll see it in every major league organization as part of the routines of some of the most accomplished baseball players on the planet. If you're looking for the same results enjoyed by these athletes, visit markpro.com and use the coupon code Cressy at checkout for an exclusive discount. Again, that's markpro.com, markpro.com, and use the coupon code Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, at checkout for an exclusive discount. Our first question relates to a recent post I made on Instagram. It says, I saw your recent post about how you're using an Oura Ring and noticed what it turned up when you were sick. What are your thoughts? I've noticed that my sleep tracking can sometimes dome me up because it doesn't always align with how I feel. So just for some context, I threw up just a screen grab of a couple of different segments over a few days from my Oura, reading while I was sick. So I was home and kind of knocked on my butt for a couple days. And what I noticed was that my resting heart rate at sleep was really elevated. My HRV numbers were really low. And then probably most significantly, I didn't really have any deep sleep. Normally, I'm a guy that actually gets a decent amount of deep sleep relative to the amount of hours I actually sleep. But in this case, I was all very, very shallow throughout the night, at least according to what the Oura Ring told me. So it is something I've been reading or using for a while, and I have found it beneficial. But I think the thing that I tell all of our athletes when they have questions about this stuff is that all tech, just like any kind of assessment, should be descriptive and not predictive. And what that means is, you know, there's obviously going to be some inherent inaccuracies with anything. Nothing's going to be completely perfect. But I think it's really important to consider that, you know, performance and injuries are always going to be multifactorial. So this is really just one piece of the puzzle. You can get a great night of sleep, but then slip on wet grass and pull your hamstrings, right? You can also get a terrible night of sleep and manage to power through, you know, an elite performance. So I think tech is really just there to help us minimize variables and get to solutions for optimization faster. So, you know, wear it over an extended period of time and try to observe some trends that help to drive some kind of programming, decision making, whatever it may be. I think we get into trouble where we let what we see on the screen tell us how we should feel instead of just interpreting it as something that might be part of a much larger equation for how it is that we feel and perform. So, you know, for me, it's really just that you have to take it for what it is. It's a piece of the puzzle. How I've used Oura is, you know, I think been really, really helpful. The first thing I'll say is that I recognize the overwhelming majority of my deep sleep comes before midnight. So I'm a guy that likes to get to bed at 9:30 way more than I like to get to bed at 11. And, you know, there's an old adage that every hour of sleep before midnight is worth 2 hours after midnight. And that absolutely seems to be the case for me. I think I can likely get away with less total sleep because more of it is deep as long as I am getting to bed pretty early. I'm in trouble if I start trying to sleep midnight to 7 versus trying to sleep, you know, 10 to 5. Those 2 hours make a really big difference for me. The other thing I noticed is that latency is a big thing for me. I hit the pillow and I'm usually out cold within 10 minutes. My wife is the exact opposite. She's someone who takes some time to fall asleep, but once she's out, she's out. I know something is off if I'm not falling asleep quickly. So probably relates to that earlier bedtime I discussed, but this is something that's really important for me to take care of. I tend to be the most productive in the morning. I think this is the case with a lot of, you know, early birds that, you know, they are getting really tired by 9, 10 o'clock at night. So if latency is off, it means that I have too much stuff going on in my brain. I need to clear the slate before I hit the hay. And then, you know, the final things that I've kind of identified is that my sleep seems to be most heavily impacted by two things. One is eating close to bed. I always seem to, you know, toss and turn all night when I eat a little bit more late in the day. You know, the Aura has definitely reflected that as well. And then I think also sleeping next to my wife, which is likely a function of temperature, noise, or ambient light. When I leave for spring training and I sleep alone, I generally sleep better. That's not a knock on my wife. I obviously love her and we've been married for a long time. But I think, you know, when you have another person in the bed with you, just like, you know, the studies that you've seen about, you know, people who sleep with their pets, there is more temperature, it's more heat, there's more noise of people tossing and turning and moving around. And then also, I think for us, there's something that's significant with respect to ambient light is, you know, there's a cell phone, maybe a baby monitor that's in the room at the same time. So it's hard to separate out what is just the circumstances versus what's just having another person, you know, laying next to you. So at the end of the day, I think all technology really has to be viewed with, you know, a favorable lens because it can really help us, but at the same time, it shouldn't drive, you know, how we feel. Instead, it should just describe how I feel. So be careful about thinking of them as perfectly predictive models. That's where people seem to get into trouble. For our second question, we have a very direct one. What's something you see as heavily overlooked in training teenage athletes? I thought this was an awesome question because we talk about this stuff so much, but I don't know that I've ever really organized my thoughts on what I think are the most important. So I couldn't decide on just one, so I picked two. And the first one I'll say is that work capacity is incredibly important for teenage athletes. And possibly even more in this population than in college and professional athletes. So let me elaborate on why. So in the high school years, athletic development should really be linear improvements across the board. You know, there's the occasional flat line of progression that might take place while an athlete is in season, but there should never really be noteworthy fall offs in fitness qualities throughout the high school years. It should be steady progress, you know, in a good path. You know, when you get to college, there's more hiccups, ups and downs. It's a more competitive landscape, and you may have more inconsistent, you know, kind of experiences across college strength conditioning experiences where a junior and a freshman might be markedly different. But I think in the high school realm, this steady linear progression is the case because athletes have a larger window of adaptation and they can be very responsive to even minimal doses of training. They're also at an age where they're more resilient. They can bounce back quickly from session to session. So it's possible to do a lot more work during the in-season period, particularly in a setting that may be more developmental than competitive. So the comparison I would use there is like, think junior varsity or freshman athletes on the development side of things versus like in a competitive landscape for, you know, seniors that are in the playoffs or something like that. So we have a couple of years where we can push them a little bit harder knowing that the game outcomes really don't matter that much. But taking it a step further, once athletes have a solid training foundation, it becomes impossible to maintain every fitness quality throughout a competitive year, which obviously gets more and more grueling in college and professional sports. Like, you can't just go out and throw 101 mile an hour fastballs year round. That's probably one of the biggest problems right now with baseball is that guys are doing that for too much of the competitive year. But over the course of time, we have to learn how to prioritize fitness qualities throughout the year. And just as important, we need to appreciate how to optimize recovery so that athletes can best display these qualities from day to day. In high school, you know, we can probably all think back to those times when, you know, maybe we went out and played a 3-hour baseball game and afterwards stuck around to play pickup hoops with our friends. Kids just seem to have unyielding abilities to recover from just about anything, and they can throw a lot of volume at themselves. I know we would get together and pick up rugby on Sundays while we were in season, and, you know, in tennis when I was in high school. So stuff that you'd never consider recommending to a professional or college athlete, high school athletes can get away with, and all the while they're adapting across multiple fitness qualities. But taking a step further, the high school athlete, this linear progression ideal that we seek is heavily dependent on the athlete building an appreciable level of work capacity in a true off season that exists. So when you have a baseball player, you know, I always love the fall spring split because, you know, they'd play football or soccer or whatever it was. And then we could, you know, get them, you know, put back into a good spot and then start a throwing program right around Thanksgiving and gradually build up to, you know, basically the third Monday in March when high school baseball starts in Massachusetts. In Florida, it's really, really challenging just because they play year round. But I think if an athlete has the initial work capacity to fall back on, we can get in more quality work in July and August during the summertime when they are still playing to at least preserve the flat line or even gain a small amount of fitness. And even in today's game, even when kids are playing travel ball, they go on the road for 2 weeks and they come back and they have a really good week of training. You know, it's not completely in season. It's kind of on off throughout the season. But I think if that work capacity was never there, pushing an athlete, even if it's just a little bit, can set performance back substantially. You know, you always kind of roll your eyes when you hear a high school kid say that he doesn't want to be sore. Like, that's the time when you have to develop. So in short, it's much easier to impose fatigue on someone who's never experienced enough fatigue to get desensitized to it. You know, shocker alert is that, you know, Major League Baseball players probably play 200 games in 230 days from the start of spring training until the end of the World Series. Nobody ever feels 100% after the first game of the season, but they know they need to get the work in because it's part of a longer term plan. So I think, you know, the takeaway here, you know, with respect to work capacity, if you're working with 15 to 18 year old athletes, you're going to have a wide variety of training experience and certainly different starting levels of work capacity. But, you know, in that umbrella, you need to determine who needs to be pushed and who needs to be held back from day to day. It might be a solid challenge, but you are going to have some younger guys that need to be pushed hard so they actually build that initial capacity so that longer term you can get more out of doing less. Keep in mind that work capacity, particularly as you age, is incredibly skill specific, right? What a center fielder needs in terms of work capacity, go stand in cleats in the outfield for hours upon hours and then be ready to go and all out sprint to try to get a ball in the gap, is very different than what a pitcher needs for work capacity to be able to go out and throw a pitch every 15 seconds, you know, 20 times, and then go sit down for 15 minutes, and then come back out and do it again over and over again. So with that said, I don't think we need to be crazy meticulous with extreme conditioning circuits in this young population. I think the name of the game for building work capacity is actually consistent, high quality training with appropriate rest intervals. You know, you're not going to build nearly as much work capacity when guys are checking their phone and taking 5 minutes between sessions, but using supersets, trisets, things like that. And then, you know, obviously conditioning for the sport in question, right? So if you're getting ready for soccer season, you got to condition for it. If you're getting ready for basketball season, you got to condition for it. For baseball season, you don't need nearly as much, you know, true aerobic and, you know, anaerobic conditioning. Instead, you need to, you know, be fast in small bursts and just preserve the aerobic capacity you built during those other seasons. So, you know, regardless, building and maintaining work capacity is a key foundation for being able to chase a wide variety of different adaptations over the course of an athletic career. You need a lot, you need to do a lot of work to acquire and ingrain new skills, but you can't do it if you're always gassed. And I think we've seen, you know, over the years, these 13, 14, 15 year olds who really don't have good work capacity because they haven't played enough pickup sports or they just haven't been exposed to it. And they're really behind on the training side of things. So I do think we've got to build a really robust aerobic base and ability to do a lot of work in a weight room to set them up for long-term success. And then the second thing, which will be a much shorter answer, I think in the teenage years, and this is an answer that I hope all the parents that are listening to this show will appreciate, taking care of nutrition and sleep is massively overlooked advantage for teenage athletes. It's actually the single biggest competitive advantage that almost every high school kid that I encounter completely overlooks. Everyone wants to know what the latest greatest supplement is. They want to take on the most aggressive weighted ball program in the world. In reality, the most important adaptations for them actually center on, you know, eating better, outsleeping your peers, really dedicating yourself to putting yourself in the best position possible to recover and then be primed for your next training session. For a third question, we're going to get a little bit more into the weeds. It says, I recall you writing somewhere that you felt like the word tendinitis was a diagnosis that was overused. Can you please elaborate more? This is definitely something that I've been shouting from the rooftops over the years. So to give you a brief background, there is a tendinopathy debate that's out there. So the word tendinitis implies an inflammatory ending. That itis on the back end is indicative of inflammation. And when you think about inflammation, it should be something that's easily controlled with cortisone injections or, you know, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, you know, everything from Advil to something that's more prescription-based. Conversely, what we actually realize is that most of the stuff that we encounter is actually a tendinosis. So that osis ending is implicating a degenerative approach. So the loading on the tissue has exceeded that tissue's tolerance for loading. And there was actually a really good study that came out. It was actually more of an article that was written up as opposed to a true study. It was Mafuli, Khan, and Pudu back in arthroscopy all the way back in 1998. So I'm going to read a quote that says, "In overuse clinical conditions in and around tendons, frank inflammation is infrequent and is associated mostly with tendon ruptures. Tendinosis implies tendon degeneration without clinical or histological signs of intratendinous inflammation and is not necessarily symptomatic. Patients undergoing an operation for Achilles tendinopathy show similar areas of degeneration. When the term tendinitis is used in a clinical context, it does not refer to a specific histopathological entity. However, tendinitis is commonly used for conditions that are truly tendinoses, and this leads athletes and coaches to underestimate the proven chronicity of the condition. The combination of pain, swelling, and impaired performance should be labeled tendinopathy." So in other words, they're saying, take a step back, use the word tendinopathy. It's a little bit more of a catch-all. But at the end of the day, most of the stuff that we're really encountering, that pain, that swelling, the impaired performance, is actually more of the degenerative changes that take place in the tendons. And really, anyone who's ever dealt with a quote-unquote tendinitis, as you know, diagnosed by a family doctor or whoever it is, knows that it's really not that easy to fix. So a lot of the traditional treatment modalities are based on the wrong diagnosis. In other words, you know, take a cortisone shot or here's a prescription anti-inflammatory. A lot of people actually get better simply because they implement rest for the tissues and not because they, you know, address the underlying causative factors. So as a really good example for this, there's a good study. I've probably said it on the podcast a few times in the past. It was actually done in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Sports Science. I think it was back in 2000. It was Cook et al. The title of the article is "Patellar Tendinopathy in Junior Basketball Players, a Controlled Clinical and Ultrasonographic Study of 268 Patellar Tendons in Players Ages 14 to 18 Years Old." So they looked at a bunch of junior basketball players in Scandinavian regions, 134 players, 268 total tendons. And when they actually talked to the athletes, only 19 athletes presented clinically with symptoms of tendinopathy. In other words, there were 19 tendons out of 134 players that actually hurt. So that's 7%. However, what they did afterwards was they ultrasound examined all of them, and they found that 26% of all the tendons could actually be diagnosed with tendinopathy based on the degenerative changes. So you're basically saying that for every one we diagnose with symptoms, there are probably three more that are overlooked. And certainly this is a junior population. You can imagine how these tendons probably looked if you went out to a men's league basketball rec league with a bunch of 45-year-old guys who are basically waiting to rupture their Achilles tendons. So what it really speaks to is that tendinopathy is really a constant give and take in every muscle in the body, and degeneration is going to be population and activity specific. So, you know, I spent a lot of time in Boston early in my career, and we always saw people who were training for the marathon, and I often joke that people would be better off just conditioning in some other way that's not as intensive and then just showing up and running the marathon and powering through it, because so many people would really get hurt during the actual training, you know, the runs to 21 miles just to get accustomed to it. I think the problem is that we get a real pattern overload with patellar tendons, Achilles tendons, whatever it may be. So certainly that's activity specific. They were running too much. If they cross trained a little bit more, I think they'd do well. And likewise, you know, population specific, older adults will generally have more tendinopathy type changes. We certainly see way more problems in smokers, people who are deficient in vitamin D, people who consume a lot of alcohol. These are all very important considerations when we talk about managing this degenerative cycle of not letting people, you know, kind of shift over that symptomatic threshold. So, you know, the second question that I would pose to myself basically after getting this first question from a listener is, how do we manage tendinosis? And I think the industry actually has a much better perspective on it now. First, we prevent it by making sure to build chronic workload without excessive acute spikes. So obviously there's some great research out there on acute and chronic workloads. Just like we're building up pitchers pitch counts, we don't have them go out and throw 90 pitches in the first game of the season if they didn't have spring training. Instead, we gradually build up that pitch count in a really skill specific way after we've built a good foundation of, you know, everything from aerobic capacity to mobility to strength to power development, all these different things that underpin high level performance. And then we gradually build it up over the course of time. Secondly, you know, we work to utilize a variety of initiatives to optimize recovery. So what's really interesting about this is you think about manual therapy, which is an option that a lot of athletes love, you know, and certainly they use self-myofascial release on the foam rollers and lacrosse balls and things like that. But a lot of people, you know, use cupping or, you know, instrument assisted soft tissue work. They may use dry needling, whatever it may be. But these things are actually all in stimulating an inflammatory response. And what's fascinating about it is inflammation is actually part of that healing process from degenerative changes. So these are actual initiatives that, you know, people have been diagnosed with tendonitis and they're actually using pro-inflammatory ways to optimize, you know, that healing cascade. So I always find that fascinating. Obviously they're, you know, stimulating the nervous system in various ways. They're probably, you know, changing some kind of fluence balance in the tissue. You know, there's a lot of talk about them, you know, kind of working on deep adhesions, you know, areas of fibrosis, which I think Bill Parisi just did a great job of talking about in his latest book. He was a recent guest on the podcast. But, you know, again, inflammation is part of the healing process. I think we got to be really careful about just knocking back a lot of anti-inflammatories all the time when we're trying to get tendons to recharge. Certainly quality nutrition, hydration, and sleep are big with this. We know athletes are more likely to get hurt when they're dehydrated, when they're malnourished, when they're sleep deprived. We know that the research on college athletes around exam time is that, you know, athletes do have far more injuries during these time periods. And then we have additional recovery approaches, things like MarkPro, contrast baths, red light therapy, hyperbaric chambers. You know, there's a host of other options out there for improving recovery as well. I think everyone has their own personal preferences. And of course, you want to avoid things that may take tendons in the wrong directions. I mentioned tobacco and alcohol use being problematic, but also, you know, certain prescription drugs, antibiotics, acne medications can be very problematic for athletes as well. We see an instance of, you know, increased tendon ruptures in some of these situations. So you always want to be mindful of, you know, if you add a prescription drug, maybe it has some side effects that could impact you athletically. And what's really fascinating, kind of that one of the next frontiers in you know, the health and human performance industries is that there are some very forward-thinking folks who are very skilled with ultrasounds that are actually using that to evaluate degenerative changes of tendons. There are a few teams in the NBA that I know scan their patellar and Achilles tendons on all their players every few weeks just to see if things are trending in a bad direction. I'm sure it plays into kind of load management strategy or them using various initiatives to try to optimize tendon healing. But I think it's a fascinating new frontier where it's a lot easier than throwing a 6'9" guy into an MRI tube. If you can just do an ultrasound and get a quick glimpse at what's going on, it may be something that we can use to evaluate how guys are progressing or responding to a given load. Additionally, when there is, you know, an actual tendinopathy in play, really there's some great new research from Dr. Keith Barr on, you know, isometrics and really isometrics are where it's at when it comes to taking care of tendons. We know that the response to that kind of loading seems to be far more favorable for, you know, actually getting to the points of tendons that need to be strengthened. He's done some awesome work on this concept of stretch shielding that I would really encourage you to check out. I think it's been transformational for the industry, myself included, to the point that, you know, we're doing isometric stuff as part of our warm-ups, both in terms of, you know, Achilles tendon, patellar tendon, but also, you know, doing stuff with the rotator cuff and throwers. Cal Dietz was one of the first to, you know, kind of to market with this one with some of his spring ankle series. So I think those guys have done a good job escalating the importance of isometric training. And certainly there's a lot of different directions you can go with it, but definitely check out Keith Barr's work. He's done some great podcasts. Additionally, you know, a good comprehensive training program should really work to distribute stress away from an overworked joint. So, you know, a lot of the cranky Achilles tendons that we've seen, you know, are really people that are using extra toe off, extra plantar flexion because, you know, they don't have a glute max, they don't have hip extensors that are really doing their job to complete hip extension. So, you know, likewise, we get patellar tendons that are banged up because the hip isn't doing its job. So really trying to find what's going on at adjacent joints that maybe subjecting one specific tendon to just too much, you know, trauma on a daily basis. And then certainly last but not least, we're seeing a stronger role for biologics like stem cell injections, PRP injections, things like that industry-wide. The research seems to be more and more compelling with each passing day as more of the larger institutions have started to devote more research to it. So I do think that's kind of the next frontier. So big picture, though, we are not dealing with nearly as much tendonitis as we think. Most of the really progressive folks out there are either calling it tendinosis, which is indicative of a degenerative change, or they're calling it tendinopathy, knowing that there probably is a little bit of an element of both in this situation, where there's a degenerative component and an inflammatory component. So I think it's always, you know, just a good look to not necessarily just hang your hat on the inflammatory approach. Thanks so much for tuning in and for your great questions. As a reminder, if you like what you hear, we'd be thrilled if you consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving us an iTunes review. Additionally, we welcome your suggestions for future guests and, you know, question submissions. So please just email elitebaseballpodcast@gmail.com if you'd like to get an inquiry answered. Thanks so much for your continued support.